If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
Working with these key kind of artisans was really a joy. And I don't know, it gave me a completely different understanding of like the meaning of building something that is not about, it's not about turning a profit. It's not about reselling it. It's like, this is hopefully going to be here long after I'm gone and will be used and loved and that, and hopefully for a long time. So I think that's a really nice idea or thing that architecture can.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Gianpiero Pugliese, founding principal at Audax with offices in Toronto, Ontario, and Palm Beach, Florida. Gianpiero is the founding principal of Audax and a licensed architect, designer, and master builder known for his award-winning work across luxury, residential, commercial, and hospitality projects. A graduate of Harvard and UC Berkeley with additional studies at IUAV in Venice, he brings a global perspective to his practice. A former lecturer at the University of Toronto and frequent industry speaker, Gianpiero is also the founder of, quote, Human Architecture, a design philosophy that reintroduces timeless principles into contemporary architecture. The project we will be talking about today is St. Catherine's Chapel in the beautiful Florence, Italy. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Nestled beneath a gently sculpted hill in Viola Park, the new home of ACF Fiorentina near Florence, St. Catherine's Chapel reveals itself slowly, more discovered than announced. The chapel reimagines one of architecture's oldest typologies through a contemporary lens, proving that innovation and tradition need not be at odds. For Gianpiero, the conception of the project began on a circuitous path and evolved into a personal journey.
The owner of the project, the client, is a gentleman named Rocco Camuso. So he's actually a family relation to me. He's my mom's cousin. But he's a very successful business executive in the United States. He runs a large cable company. He is an immigrant from Italy, moved to the Bronx, played soccer when he was young, ended up doing very well in school, and ended up going to Columbia University on a soccer scholarship. He has always had a passion for the sport of soccer throughout his life. So for many years, he was trying to buy a soccer club. In 2019, he ended up securing a deal to purchase the soccer club in Florence, Italy. He's the owner of ACF Fiorentina. So he and I, you know, we're different generations. He's much older than I am. But I think there was sort of a respect, a mutual admiration to some degree. You know, he's a very successful person. But through his academic work experience and my academic experience in our family, we were sort of like outliers to some degree. So, you know, he called me up when he was looking to, when he bought the team, and he said, look, I have this goal in mind. I want to build a new training center for the soccer club. He goes, you know, I know this is a bit out of your sort of everyday activity, but, you know, you're an architect. You know, I have a construction business as well here. You speak Italian, which is valuable. You've lived in Italy. You know what the environment's like. Would you be interested in helping me with this project? And I was like, okay, of course. How could I say no? So that was the origin of it. So he basically brought me on as his advisor, his senior advisor. And, you know, I represented his interests throughout the course of the development of this project. So he ended up, in 2019, he bought about 50 acres of land just outside of Florence in a town called Bagno di Poli. It was farmland. And the intention then was to build a new training facility, the most state-of-the-art training facility in Europe. And at the time, all of the various activities in Florence, the soccer club, were sort of dispersed throughout the metropolitan area. So the men's program, the women's program, the youth program, the administration, the practice fields, they were all spread out all over the place. So his vision was to consolidate everybody onto one campus and build this new sort of revolutionary kind of space. So we ended up, I was there during the purchase and sale agreement of the land. Once we bought the land, we interviewed architects. It was interesting because I was on the other side of the coin. I was interviewing architects. You know, it was really interesting to be on the flip side of you know, the client interviewing an architect. Anyway, we ended up hiring an architect out of Florence who's very, very well known in Florence and in Italy, named Marco Casamonte, and his company is called Arkea. So they were the architects for the entire campus of the project. As we were developing the kind of project, incidentally, let me finish on the main project. So we ended up working, you know, with the design team to develop that entire campus. We ended up putting a tender bid together, awarded the contract to a builder, a local builder from Florence, and then the buildings were built. So it was about 120 million euro development project. 300,000 square feet, massive, 7 buildings, 12 soccer fields. It was a big deal. We designed and got the approval in 1 year, and we built it in 2 years. Unprecedented. So anyway, as part of that whole project, I was having dinner with Rocco and his family, his wife and his son, while we were in the design process. And we had just, I took them to the Duomo because I wanted them to see it in Florence. So after we had lunch, and we were sitting around the table, we started talking about how on the university campuses, there's always a chapel. So on Columbia University campus, there's a chapel. On the Harvard campus, there's a chapel. And we were like maybe we should do a chapel at the training center, because the training center is almost like this. It's like a campus for the study of soccer, if you will. Immediately, when the idea came up, I said to him, I go, okay, I'm going to do the chapel. Personally, I don't want to have any questions about who's going to design it. I'm designing the chapel. Okay? That's it. He's like, okay, go ahead. And that was it. And after that, he said, okay, do what you want to do. And his idea of what it was going to be versus what we ended up doing, I think, was probably very different. But in the end, everybody was so blown away by, I guess, the unique sort of unexpected solution for the design of a chapel that we came up with. So that's the background of it, but it's a very personal project. In the end, we consecrated the chapel. We had the Archbishop of Florence was there to consecrate the chapel. And he told us this was the first religious space that was consecrated in the past 35 years. Because they haven't built any, because, you know, religious following is kind of, it's dwindling, right? So anyway, so we had the consecration. And then the next day, the first sort of ceremony was the baptism of my children. So there's an image, I think you might see it on the website. There's an image with a woman holding a child, but the light's kind of shining on her. That's my wife and son. It was very moving. You know, it's been, since then, it's been a kind of a heart for many of the members of the community team, at least, you know. About a year ago, one of the main managers of the club passed away suddenly, and they ended up doing the funeral ceremony there at the chapel as well, right? It's sort of like, it's a great, so it was almost like, it's like kind of a good thing to have for a large community of people. So anyway, that's the background of how we got to it. But then the design, my whole approach to the design was really then, okay, how do I do this in Florence in a modern, you know, the design of the training center is more modern, right? So like, what should this be? And with working in Italy, it's like, wow, everybody's got an opinion, obviously. But I just said, this is what we're going to do. And because I had a bit of the, you know, I had the confidence of the client because, you know, had a mandate to do something, and he kind of let us do it. So it's pretty cool.
The decision to locate the chapel entirely underground reframes the conventional narrative of vertical transcendence. Instead of aspiring upward through height or spire, the architecture turns inward and downward, using compression, enclosure, and emergence of light to shape experience.
We're trying to determine where to locate the chapel itself. And it's funny because if you look at the design of the training center, there's sort of a lake in the middle. It's basically a stormwater retention pond that is at the very heart of the campus. It's a very visible location. So the initial idea was to actually build a freestanding structure in that lake. And it's funny because I think there was a bit of reservation by the community of building a chapel. And I don't know, Florence and Bologna especially are probably the most left-leaning parts of Italy to some degree. And their attitude towards religion is that it's, you know, I'm not speaking for everybody, and that's, but there's a kind of conversation that this is something of the past. This is not what we do today, right? Which is the reason why they're not building chapels the way they used to. The following is not something that is what it used to be. To the point where it was like the idea of putting a chapel out in a visible area was, I think, uncomfortable for some people. There was also conversation that it should be non-denominational, it should be a spiritual place. And we said, no, we're not going to do that because this is our faith and this is what we want to do, private space. So the idea of putting it elsewhere, we, you know, started looking at architectural ideas. And I had come up with a concept for this freestanding structure. But then we started looking at the rest of the site. And if you look at the training center, there's a building in the middle of the training center, which is like a hill. And we had to build that hill because the heritage department, so they have a heritage control over the entire, they call it paesaggio, which is the landscape heritage. So anything you can see from the hills of Florence is controlled and mandated. So because of the site was farmland, they didn't want a building in the middle of the site. So we ended up proposing the solution to have a hill that was covered with grass, right? So it ended up becoming this sort of like hidden building. Now with that, as you kind of enter it, there was this space to the side at the bottom underneath this hill that I kind of looked at and I thought, you know, that could be an interesting place for the chapel actually, because it's discreet. Not that I was trying to hide it on purpose. That wasn't it. It was also logistically, this was an added component to the project that we didn't, you know, we to build a new building would have required a new approval and so on and so forth. So we had this extra space at the bottom of this hill. And I was like, you know what, that could be an amazing opportunity. So the way it's organized, so we ended up coming up with this concept of carving out this space inside the hill. Let's call it inside an actual piece of earth. And it's funny that through the necessity of some of those obstacles, it ended up producing the beauty that the project ended up having. So sometimes in architecture, I think one of the hardest things in architecture is when you have a blank slate, when you have nothing to bounce off of, right? To create, you know, that's why I think the beauty of historical cities is so evident, is because you're building, you're layering, and you're responding to what's come before you. So when you're sort of starting with a blank slate, it's hard to respond to context and history. So anyway, so we ended up nestling it underneath the hill. So I started doing studies of chapels, Renaissance chapels, and started trying to understand how they were organized. Like, a lot of chapels don't present themselves on the facade, on the outside in the civic space. You kind of have to walk through a cloister, go through a series of arches, and then you kind of come into the space, and then it unfolds. And it's backed on, you know, it's stuck in between, like, buildings, so the only light that comes in is from the top. So I started looking at that. I said, okay, well, we have a similar situation. So the actual heart of the chapel, we kept in a very classical form of an oval, right? And what we did is we used the contour of the hill to create the portico and the colonnade that you use to enter into the chapel. And what was interesting, the floor plan, it almost looks, you enter into the portico from two sides. Okay, so it's almost like this curve like this, and then there's an oval right in the middle. Now, because the hill slopes up as you get to the middle, the arcade actually rises, right? So when you come in, the columns are not perfectly similar to each other. You basically have this space that rises, but it doesn't just rise, it also curves. So it rises and curves to the point where there's this sort of moment, this apex, where then you're on center, perfectly symmetrical with the center of the oval of the chapel. And then on that center line, you have the crucifix, you have the altar, the baptismal font, and the painting of St. Catherine with the Virgin Mary and Jesus. So it's a really cool kind of like geometry. So it reminds me of the sort of forced perspective of some of the Renaissance architects that they did in terms of playing with the size of the colonnade. But what's different is that it actually curves. So it's actually got this sort of parametric geometry that is, you know, it's the kind of stuff when I was in school that Frank Gehry and Zaha Hadid, they were really pioneers in that type of computer software that allowed for this kind of organic kind of 3D modeling. So it's very advanced from a, let's say, technical execution. But then when you go into the space, it resonates as this sort of like, it carries the tradition of the earlier chapels embedded in its DNA. So it's different. Yeah, so it's an amazing space. And then when you get into the chapel itself, the core of it, it's a perfect oval. And then in section, it's also an oval. So the acoustics are quite profound. When you're at the altar, you don't like, there's no, we have a bit of lighting. We have an LED light strip, but really there's no need for air conditioning. There's no need for artificial light, and there's no need for any acoustics. Like during the day, if you want to have a mass there, you get the natural light through the oculus and through the side. You get acoustics are perfect. You can whisper at the altar and you can hear it all around. Because it's under this hill, it's kind of got this natural, Florence is very hot and it's got this natural sort of inertial mass that keeps the temperature stable. So I don't know. I think doing it, I never realized what I was doing until it kind of came together and I was like, wow, this is bigger than what I thought. Not bigger physically, but this is more important than what I realized I was doing.
The chapel departs from the traditional Latin cross plan in favor of a sculpted oval volume. Approach is defined by a curving parametric arcade embedded into the hillside site, functioning as a contemporary reinterpretation of the narthex.
I think the biggest challenge was communicating the geometry of the arcade from a concept to the site, because it was a remote, it was in Italy and I was here in Toronto. I was traveling back and forth, and then we had COVID at a certain period of time during the process, which restricted our ability to go there as much as we wanted. So getting the execution of the arches to what the tension was in terms of our design was a challenge communicating that. But I have to say that the people in Italy, working in Italy was great, because everybody there, I don't know, it's weird. Even down to the site superintendent, they have a sensibility to design that you don't find in the same way you find here. You know, I was talking to the super and we were talking about one of the lines of the arch and how I wanted it to kind of align and then terminate right at the moment where another line was terminating in the horizontal plane. And he was like, oh, you mean like this? And he understood it right away. And that was very refreshing. I was like, okay, we're in good hands, because this guy understands what I'm talking about. Especially at the end, because, you know, the site condition versus what you draw is always different. So we had, you know, I would go on site and meet with the guys and, you know, work with the whole team that was there, between the local architects and the engineers and the drywall guys and the framers and the whole group. And but it was great, because I kind of, because it was a very personal project for Rocco, it was almost like it almost got this special treatment. And I think a lot of people were really, I don't know, they were enthusiastic to be working on it as well. So it was nice. It didn't feel like a regular project, because we do a lot of, you know, residential development projects, and it's like, it's a business, right? So, okay, we get it done. It's got to be this. The only mandate I had was it had to be done for the grand opening. That was the stress level, that we had to get the thing done by the grand opening. That was a big pressure, which we did. So the challenge of communicating the geometry to the site, but we did a great job in the end. It worked out really well. No, look, I think it's not very interesting, but the slope of the hill restricted the height of the oval of the ceiling. So we had to kind of work with that limit and create a geometry that would fit into that space. Originally, the oculus, my original vision for the oculus was that it was actually open to the air above. So I had this idea of an open air oculus, where when it rained, the water would actually come into the space, which would have been quite beautiful. But I think we discussed the logistics of how that would be operated, and the maintenance and the water and the HVAC and all this different stuff. So in the end, we ended up doing a skylight, but I didn't want to see the skylight. I didn't want to see any of the mechanisms of the skylight. So we had to kind of look at the different angles that you saw through the oculus to preserve light coming in, but not seeing the frame of the window. So that was interesting.
The oval is expressed as a singular carved form, emphasizing interior spatial coherence over exterior articulation, a deliberate shift from representational facade to experiential interior.
You have a concrete walls that, let's say, they're retaining walls. I don't know how we would define them. Combination of, let's say, retaining walls enclosing this sort of oval. But when we did the oval, the walls themselves were more faceted, because we didn't actually pour curved walls. We built walls that were sort of more simple. And then what ended up happening, even with the archway, right? So the archway, we poured the walls, but then we came in and did framing on the interior to create the actual space, that the curves themselves. The same with the ceiling, and the same with the walls, and the same with the arches. So all the arches are done in drywall that are framed in steel studs. The same with the ceiling of the oval, and then the perimeter walls as well. Now, the difference with the perimeter walls is that they have to hold the marble slabs. So that's kind of the approach to it, is that we built like this sort of shell that contained the backfill of the earth, but then on the inside, we did it in light steel stud framing in order to create the shapes that we're creating. So that's the technical construction methodology that was employed.
Carrara marble is featured prominently for liturgical furnishings, anchoring the space in both regional material tradition and architectural longevity.
The original vision, so we have two areas where we have marble primarily. So in the oval of the chapel, all of the walls up until about, I think, 8 feet, 7 or 8 feet high, is all clad in marble. Okay. Then you have the altar, you have the podium, you have the platform of where the altar is that you step on, and that's rendered in marble. And then you have the baptismal font. Those are the main kind of component. And then the chair where the priest sits, the base of that is also done in marble. So there are basically two types of marble that we used in the space. One is, I forget the exact spec. I think the ones on the wall are more of like a Bianco Carrara. And then the baptismal font is like a statuario marble that has a bit more veining in it. So what the vision was for, let's talk about the walls first. I wanted that to sort of almost disappear to some degree. I wanted it to feel like you were in a monolithic kind of stone, like you're carved out of that stone. So we had to find a marble that so those were actually done in slabs, vertical slabs that were kind of glued, let's say, onto the perimeter of the wall. But if you look at the challenge there, so the original kind of economical way of doing it was actually to have straight slabs that were then faceted. So it would have had the effect of, you would see the shadow line between where the two pieces came together, but were not in plane with each other. They would have been slightly tilted. That would have had an effect of creating like basically a repetition of vertical lines and shadows, which is not what I wanted. So what we did is we said, okay, what are we going to do? This is where I had a little bit of a push because we were up against a bit of a budget, but you know, I said this is absolutely necessary for the success of this. So what we ended up doing is actually in introducing a very slight, gentle bevel to every slab. So in the fabrication process, that's more expensive because you have to start with a thicker slab. You have to actually fabricate each one individually because no two on an oval are the same radius, right? It's symmetrical down the middle. So you're going to have on one side versus the other, you'll have some similarity. So anyway, that was an important decision. And then we had to pick a slab that when it was sequenced, didn't have so much veining that it would be obvious that there was a joint in the panel. So that was the goal of the selection of the slab for that. When it came to the altar and to the fountain, those are carved out of a block of stone, right? So the baptismal fountain especially, that one I love because it's like, it was actually fabricated on a, like a router, basically. I have a photo, I don't know if it's on the website or not, but I have a photo of how they were fabricating. They would like spin it and carve it. So it's pretty cool. So the selection of the stone was interesting. So there was a company we work with called, I never pronounce it properly. We can get you the details. It's called Onro or something like that. It's like a H-U with an X and something. But they were the marble fabricators that we worked with. So we went to go see their fabrication facility. And when we were there, they took us up to the quarry. So this is in Massa di Carrara, just outside Florence. Beautiful. It's like the most beautiful place in the world. You climb this mountain and you're embedded in a marble quarry overlooking the Mediterranean. It's just like, it blows you away. And, you know, when we were up there, the guy was pointing, he's like, that's where Michelangelo quarried the stone for the statue of David. Now, whether that's true or not, you know, Italians can sometimes they're good tour guides, right? So they'll say, hey, that's where Leonardo da Vinci lived. And people are, oh, really? Anyway. But I kind of believed it because it's like he was up there for sure, because this was where all of that stone was drawn from over the years. Anyway, so we did take a tour of their quarries, and you know, it's interesting. You learn a lot about how stone is extracted. You learn a lot about how the veining you know, because what we see in the showrooms, you know, here in Toronto, we see the finished slab that is presented to you as a rectangle with the veining, and it's, but when you go into the quarry, you understand sort of where it's drawn from and how it's sequenced and how it's cut in which direction, where the imperfections are, where the good slab is, where the bad slab is, and you really become fluent in knowing what you're. It's like wine, you know, you can drink a bottle of wine, but you could also then go to a vineyard and understand how they cultivate the grapes, and, you know, all the different, so it's almost like its own world to some degree. So we ended up selecting slabs that were quarried from their quarry, but we ended up selecting them from their inventory that were already quarried, because we needed the, first of all, we needed the, what was supplied, what was available, right? We took the stone and then from that went and picked the perfect stone for the two different applications. And that's what they did. So they fabricated all of the stone for the walls and the altar and the fountain, and they installed it. So it was very cool. It was so cool to go up there and see it. And it's just like the air is so fresh, and it was a beautiful sunny day, and the blue sky against the white marble is just like in awe. It's spectacular. So, you know, that was one of those like benefits. And a lot of designers go to quarries. It's not like, that's kind of like a rite of passage to some degree, you know, for an interior designer to go to visit the marble quarry. But to do it in Florence on a chapel that we're in, that was like another next level kind of thing. It's pretty cool.
Site-specific works, some digitally replicated, others traditionally crafted, are the result of a careful synthesis of age-old techniques and advanced fabrication technologies. One such work was a commissioned Renaissance-style oil painting by Tom Richards that weaves historical continuity into the contemporary setting.
When I was designing it originally, if you look at the floor plan of the chapel, like I said, it's an oval with a center axis. So the original design was to have the crucifix behind the altar, have an altar, and then the main aisle. And what I wanted was directly opposite that. I wanted to have either a statue or a painting or a bas relief sculpture of St. Catherine of Siena. So we decided to dedicate it to St. Catherine of Siena. She's a patron saint, very famous in the region. She's sort of a peacemaker, and she's famous for making peace between Florence and Siena. They were warring families at the time. And then Rocco's wife is Catherine as well. So it was a nice kind of fitting connection to do that. And so we wanted to dedicate it to St. Catherine. So my idea was to put a statue of St. Catherine right on the axis. Part of the approval process for this chapel was that in order for it to become rolled into the Archdiocese of Florence, it needed to satisfy certain rules, let's say, of the Catholic Church. So while we were designing it, we engaged with forget his official title, but he's basically a, you know, maybe second or third in command with the Archbishop of Florence. So he was a priest who was an advisor basically to us. We went to go have a meeting with him, and the offices where they operate out of were right across from the main Duomo. We met with him. He basically gave us a lot of pointers about how their liturgy unfolds during the Mass and what they need and what they don't need. So some of the technical things, for example, the podium, the lectern, right, where you stand and speak has to be big enough to hold a Bible or hold a book that's this big versus this big. So it's like getting those dimensions right. The altar needed to be at least this dimension, at least this high, and it had to function in this way. The chairs where the priest sits. So a lot of like the positioning and the size of those things we vetted through him. So he's almost like a church design consultant in a way. But one of the big things he said to me, he goes, you cannot have St. Catherine opposite Jesus on the wall. because you're putting the hierarchy is wrong. Because in every chapel, you need an image of the Virgin Mary as well. And the Virgin Mary cannot be subservient to a saint. So he said, if you want, you can put the Virgin Mary on axis, and then the saint could be off to the side. And I was like, oh, well, we didn't have in our budget a commission for two pieces of art. So I'm like, okay, we'll have to figure that out. And I didn't like the idea of St. Catherine being off to the side. We didn't have a really good spot for it. So I kind of racked my brain. I went back and I did some sketches and I said, okay, what if we did this? What if we commission a painting of the Virgin Mary with Jesus and then have St. Catherine in the painting as a sort of character in the painting? And he said, as long as the Virgin Mary is the main focus, then you can do that. So I did a sketch concept of that. And I told him, I'm like, well, what do you think if we do this? He goes, you can do that. That would be acceptable. So I said, okay, now I'm going to figure out how to get this thing done. So we're going to do a sculpture at first. Then we ended up deciding to do a painting for a variety of reasons. I think my cousin Rocco and his wife started to realize that there was no color in the design. It was all white. And I think that got him a little bit like nervous. He's like, I'm not used to a church not having any artwork and color, something more, let's say, traditional. So I thought it would be really interesting to actually commission an original painting in a kind of classical form and hang that on the wall. It's almost like a gallery piece. So there's a gentleman named Tom Richards that I really loved his work. And I was following him on Instagram and I saw that he was located in Florence. Turns out he was at the time the director of the Florence Academy of Art. So I called him. So he's an English gentleman. I called him out of the blue. I got his phone number and he said, "Hi, Tom, you don't know me. My name is Giampiero. I represent the owner of ACF Fiorentina. We're building a chapel and I'd like to commission you to do a painting." He hung up the phone at me because he thought it was a prank call. He goes, "What the hell? Like, this is a bunch of crap. Like, what is this?" So call him back. I'm like, no, it's for real. We want, and he's like, okay. So I ended up meeting with him and he was so like blown away by the opportunity to do this because it was like, how cool is that? Right. So he and I worked together kind of developing a concept and then he ran with it. He was like, okay. Then I'm like, Tom, just create something beautiful. So he did a few. It's interesting. Never commissioned a painting. I never worked with an artist in that way, right? And then he also brought forward an amazing craftsman to build the frame, which is another artwork. So that frame is a very, let's say, Florentine. It has a lot of Florentine features to it, specifically the bracket, the scroll bracket on the side. And then at the bottom of the frame, there's a lily, which is, it's called a Giglio, which is the symbol of Florence. If you look at the soccer club of Florence, their logo is actually this lily. And then in the painting itself, you had basically Virgin Mary. And what was interesting is behind, as a backdrop to the painting, he introduced this white arch. So it was almost like she was in the chapel. It was really like he did that. And I was like, oh, that's very cool. Because he was kind of tying the two, is bringing that in, bringing it to earth in a way. And then this very kind of meek, loving St. Catherine presenting a lily to the baby and to the Virgin Mary. So it was a very symbolic sort of like connection to Florence with the lily, connection to Siena, this sort of like connection with the architecture of the chapel in the painting. It just has a lot of symbolism in it. So that's the story of the painting, and it's amazing.
A bronze crucifix inspired by Ferdinando Taca and plaster stations of the cross are integrated as architectural components rather than applied decoration.
So there was a gallery called the Freely Gallery in Florence, and what they are, they sell sculptures, basically, and they manufacture sculptures. But they're really a foundry where they cast bronze artwork. So they have lots of castings and lots of sculptures. I needed art for two things. We needed the crucifix, but we also needed the Stations of the Cross. So in the aisle or the arcade, you'll see these square plaster relief sculptures. So what we were fortunate enough to find, they actually had the molds already done. So we ended up commissioning them to fabricate 13, I think. I forget how many there are. I'm being bad right now. We didn't have enough arches to have one for every Station of the Cross. Anyway, so we had this Freely Gallery cast these plaster relief moldings for all of the Stations of the Cross. So that kind of put that exercise to bed. Finally, the crucifix was sort of then the main piece. So this was very interesting, actually. So Freely Gallery, incidentally, they've been around for, you know, this is one of those multi-generational family artisans. They were the same foundry that cast the replicas of the doors on the baptistry of Florence. So the original doors on the baptistry actually are in a museum. So the ones that are out in the field in public, those are replicas. So those replicas were made by Freely Gallery. So it's a really interesting kind of like, there's like some serious like lineage in the culture of Florence to this gallery. So we worked with them. They had this beautiful crucifix in their gallery that I thought was perfect for our chapel, but it was like 13 feet tall, too big. They had the mold and they had the rights to replicate this statue. It's actually a replica of a crucifix by a sculptor named Ferdinando Taca. And there's a cathedral in, I think it's Prato, which is the town outside of Florence, where the original sculpture exists. So they had the right to the replica of that. So we actually engaged them to do a reduced size replica of that statue of Jesus. And then we designed the crucifix, the wood, in a dark oak with a dark stain that matched actually the pews. So the pews and the wood of the crucifix was actually of the same material. So it kind of tied everything together. But the detail on that statue is so beautiful. It's such a well-executed, beautiful piece of art. Working with these key kind of artisans was really a joy. And I don't know, it gave me a completely different understanding of like the meaning of building something that is not about, it's not about turning profit. It's not about reselling it. It's like, this is hopefully going to be here long after I'm gone and will be used and loved and that, and hopefully for a long time. So I think that's a really nice idea or thing that architecture can.
Beyond the project's familial tie, Giampiero reflects on the emotional connection the chapel instills on a personal level and what a new defined structure means to the community.
The effect on me, I think, has happened during the process and then after the process. Not so much at the beginning when we were designing it, which is strange. You know, it's funny, you know, I don't want to get too sort of esoteric here, but yeah, you know, I grew up, I'm Italian, and we traditionally, our culture, we grow up in a Catholic environment, go to church, you know, do the thing, right? But then for a good part of my life, I sort of, not that you abandon it, but you don't follow it as much, and you kind of live your life and you move away from it to some degree. And what I found was that around the time that this project came about, not because of it exclusively, but I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, you know, I was married. I didn't even get married in a church, you know, figure that, right? But after having my first child and then my second child and being married, and you start to see sort of the things about the world and about life, the creation of life, and you know, you look at these beautiful creatures, like, where did they come from? And you start to think about, you know, so you start being you're a bit more questioning and you're a bit more mature and you've lived your life and you see a lot of things that happen in the world and you're kind of like, okay, where am I going? What's the explanation for everything? So when this chapel commission came about, my knowledge and my sort of relationship to our spirituality was sort of different than it is now. And I think in a way, the project itself brought me closer to our tradition, just doing it, because I started to really understand the reason why these traditions are so helpful for people in their lives when they're in need. You know, when you're going through difficult times and having somebody or something to lean on, having a philosophy or an idea that you can kind of helps you cope with the difficulties of life and the challenges. Also the celebrations, like I start to really now appreciate why, you know, for millennia, it's every religion really has this role. And every religion to some degree talks about the same thing. It's like, what's beyond this? What's the metaphysical? What is God? Where did we come from? How are we created? Where are we going? Like, these are not political questions about, you know, anything. It's about spirituality. So I think designing the space, I think even myself walking into it, because it was under construction and I was in Toronto and I was flying back. So I only saw the finished product, like when everybody else saw the finished product. And it had the same effect on me. It gave me goosebumps when I walked in. I was like, whoa, this is really nice. It's very calming. It's a peaceful place. The light, the sound, the smell, you know, when they burn the incense in that space and the natural lights coming through the oculus and the sound of the footsteps that echo, it's this really like peaceful, calming place. And it's the same feeling you get when you walk into all of the chapels that are built in Florence and Italy. You know, when you walk into the spaces, you get that feeling. And I think it's the permanence of the stone. It's the natural light. So I think, you know, the codification of the axioms of human architecture actually came after I designed the chapel. And I only realized that I was using those principles in the chapel while I was designing it. So symmetry, the proportion of the oval, the proportion of the arches, the repetition of the stations of the cross, the materiality of the bronze and the marble. And then the emotive, obviously, was this light coming through the ceiling. That's an emotional reaction. So I was like, oh my God, this has all of those things. And that's why it's touching people in the way it's touching them. So it's very special. But like I said, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I really went on my instinct, having kind of collected, I think, through my entire career and life experience, those sentiments that I talked about earlier, about beauty and you know, modernism and tradition. And I opted not to do a traditional chapel, right? Because it had to work in that environment. So no, I don't think there's ever going to be another, like, it's a once in a lifetime thing, 100%. There's never going to be something like that. For me, I try to pass this on to young people and my own children. It's like, to lead a very fulfilling life, you really have to be open to challenging yourself and to trying and being involved in things that are outside of your comfort zone or outside of what you're used to doing. And this was definitely not a distraction, but definitely something off of left field from what my practice was. But I would have been a fool not to have taken advantage of it. So anytime these kind of things come your way, you know, you want to tackle them and grab them and absorb that experience.
For Jean-Pierre, St. Catherine's Chapel is a reminder of how a project can transcend a pragmatic approach to design when beauty is considered first and foremost.
You know, sometimes we get limited by our concern for practicality and budget and don't let the beauty lead. And I think that this project shows that you've got to let beauty lead first, and then everything else comes second. And, you know, I was having dinner with a client last night, actually. And he told me, we did a cottage for him, this beautiful cottage, spent a lot of money. And he goes, he goes, thank God the builder was not really putting good budgets together, because if I had known how much I was going to spend, I might not have done it. But he said, thank God I did, because it's so beautiful what we built. So that's a bit of a lesson. Sometimes I have a kind of pragmatic way of providing service where you're like, okay, well, this is the budget schedule and we've got to get it. But that was before I realized how important beauty is in the work that we're doing. And when that emotional reaction to projects happens, ironically, the financial success, I think, comes with it, actually, in a better way, because it's more valued, ultimately. It becomes a piece of value that it wouldn't otherwise have. So there's this, you can't put a pro forma, it's hard to put a number on that, right? So that's what I've learned, I think, from this project.
Guided by the firm's philosophy of human architecture, St. Catherine's Chapel translates timeless principles of beauty, meaning, and craftsmanship into a modern language that feels both innovative and deeply human. The result is a sacred space that honors the past while speaking unmistakably to the present, quiet, resonant, and enduring. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what advice Jean Piero would give to other architects and students looking to employ the philosophy of human architecture into more of their work.
So I didn't realize this when I was going to university, but there are two, or one in particular, one university that is sort of the, what's the word, for best in class in terms of teaching classical architecture, is the University of Notre Dame. You know, I actually interviewed a few students there as candidates for working. And it's amazing what they're able to do. It's what gives me hope, because I don't think we've lost the ability to do this type of work. I have a lot of the people that work for me are actually great artists. One of the reasons I hire them is because I like how I know that they can draw really well. But what I found is, because of the nature of how we do work, you don't draw as much as you want to draw, or because it has its pros and its cons, obviously. So I would say to young students, if you haven't gone to school yet and you're interested in classical architecture, you should look at a school like, say, University of Notre Dame. If you're already out of school, I would ask you to sort of really question what you're being taught and say, do I really believe this, or am I told I have to believe this? What does your gut say when it comes to beauty? Do you really like concrete as much as you're told you're supposed to like it, right? Do you really like rusted out chain link fence as much as you're told you're supposed to like it? Or do you think marble and leather and brass is better? You know, do you really hate ornament or not? So really question yourself. And then if your answer is, hey, well, I feel this way, then be free not to. There's a whole other world of architecture and design that is a kind of, it's a, in a way, a counterculture to the academic elite kind of environments. You know, Robert Stern recently passed away, and it's funny. So, you know, I'll leave you with this, because I think it's a good anecdote. I didn't know much when I was going to university. You're very young. You don't know anything. You think you go to an elite school, you realize you're like looking up to some 28-year-old like PhD candidate who they don't know anything either, right? Because they've never actually really built. You're looking up to the wrong mentors to some degree. But anyway, so I was accepted to a number of universities, and one of the schools that I was looking at was Yale University. And at the time, Robert Stern was the dean, and they had an open house for all the acceptees to go visit and see, and where are you going to go? So I remember going to the open house, and there was another student who was with me, who I was sort of spending some time with. And I remember at the time, he spoke about Robert Stern with such disdain. And he sort of like made him sound like he was this sort of like right-wing fanatical traditionalist that we shouldn't even be talking to this guy, right? And it left an impression in my mind. I was like, oh, Robert Stern, I don't know, I want to go to this school, because he's like, so, and he actually like, he kind of insulted him because he was asked, I think he asked him a question or something, but he spoke, it was such kind of disrespect. And I remember that. And then, you know, 20 years later, I look at the work I'm doing, and so much of it is inspired by a lot of what Robert Stern has been doing, where it's like a return to kind of classical ideas. I see how people love it. I see how the value of the properties that he designs is so good. I see the layouts are very well put together, the sequence of spaces, the living spaces, the way the kitchens, you know, the interior residential components. So I'm like, why was that student, you know, had this attitude? And I realized it's because we're taught by a lot of like people that want to dismantle tradition, you know, and I think that's a problem. So we gotta, you know, we have to also change the culture and understand that making building, and then you have students that come out of these universities that then they don't have any practical skills because they're reading philosophy instead of learning about building science. And then they have no aesthetic skills because they've been told that everything in the past is bad. So they come out with this sort of like angry attitude towards the world. It doesn't help the industry. It doesn't help the hiring people that come out of that process is not good. You have to retrain them. So the ones that you find that have some sort of like hope, you end up having to mentor them and train them, but that should have been done a long time ago. So that's my biggest critique about the industry and where it's going. I'm hoping things change. I think Robert Stern himself had a big impact on changing the conversation. Now, again, as I said before, it's not about modernism or traditional design or what style. You know that. You see my work. We don't, you know, the chapel is not a traditional building. But if you don't have these basic skills of drawing and understanding proportion and hierarchy and how to lay things out and how to compose things and how to let beauty unfold through materials, through composition, if you don't have those skills, then you're not going to be able to do great work, in my opinion. So that's what I would say to young people. Be aware of what you're not being taught.
I truly enjoyed this conversation with Gianpiero. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I created a sort of list of goals and objectives for myself many years ago. And on that list, which ended up kind of being the last one on the list, is like, what legacy, what are you leaving behind? What are you doing for the continuity of your life into the future and, you know, for society? In the end, I hope that, you know, something like the book that we're writing, I think hopefully if it can touch enough people that can get them to start thinking about what we've been talking about today, that, hey, beauty, of these principles of beauty that I think are objective, that if I can influence enough people to sort of see that and have it impact the work that they do, I hope bit by bit that it will create a more beautiful environment for people. And I think enriching, you know, our mission statement as a company is to enrich the lives of people by creating beautiful places. That's my mandate, right? So I think it's by creating beautiful places and by giving a tool like the book or the theory to other people that can maybe adapt that to their own future, I think is really important. And then, you know, with my family and my children, they're obviously the biggest thing we leave behind. I haven't talked much about it, but that fundamentally is the most important project that I'll ever work on, is the project of your family and your children. And you hope to pass on a lot of these things and, you know, what you've, I think it's important to learn from your, like, that's the biggest lesson. It's like, if you can learn from your parents and not be so, it's hard when you're young because you kind of rebel against your parents. But like, there's wisdom there. If you don't have to relearn from their mistakes and you can build on their successes, that gets you, it gets you halfway forward, right? So I think that's the fact that we exist in a continuum is the reason the idea of legacy even exists. It's this idea of taking the legacy from the past and then building on it and then leaving something else for the future. So human architecture, I hope, is what it is.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.